This is the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And today I'm going to do an interview about good garden bugs. Usually when we talk about insects, sometimes we're talking about the ones that come into our garden and eat our plants. But this is a book. It's entitled Good Garden Bugs, Everything You Need to Know About Beneficial Predatory Insects. And it's written by Mary Gardner. She's an assistant professor of entomology and extension school instructor at Ohio State University. She works not only with undergraduate and graduate students, but with backyard gardeners, community gardeners, and small farmers to teach them about working with beneficial insects to improve their crops. Mary, thanks for joining me today on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, why the need for the book?
Well, I really saw a need. There's a lot of great garden books out there talking about how to identify some of the main pests in the garden and also some great pollinator resources showing how to identify and enhance gardens for pollinators. And I wanted to create sort of the same type of guide for predators and parasitoids. These are the insects that consume pests in your garden. And I really wanted to focus an entire book on telling some of their interesting stories.
Well, I know the first thing I did when I opened the book, and you've got this ordered very carefully, and it's nice because I can go from one to the next, lots of color pictures. The first thing that I opened up to, I saw a soldier beetle, and I went, whoops, maybe I shouldn't be crushing that one, because I spend a lot of time out in the garden. So I can see, number one, this being very helpful as you're able to look at these various photos to know, okay, what is one I should maybe reconsider what I've been doing with them? I know for many people, they just think, all insects are bad. But that's not the case. There are so many beneficial insects that are out there that we should be trying to attract to our gardens.
Well, exactly. And I think the first step in appreciating some of the benefits that insects provide is understanding what some of those are. So insects are pollinators. They provide natural pest control. They decompose litter and provide aeration to soil. They provide so many important benefits in the garden. And if you want to understand what insects you need to be aware of from a pest standpoint, you need to be able to separate some of these beneficial insects from the pests.
Just be specific here. What separates a beneficial from a pest? What's your definition?
Well, a beneficial insect is something that's not causing yield loss to your crop plants. It's not causing damage of leaves and fruits. These are things that are providing ecosystem services, so things like pollination and natural pest control. But one of the challenges is when you go out to a garden and you see an insect sitting there, it might not be doing any activity. It might just be resting on a leaf. How do you know what that insect is doing? And so from a predator and parasitoid standpoint, I wanted to provide as detailed of a reference book as possible so people could see, you know, enough pictures and have enough information to be able to identify most of the beneficial predator and parasitoid fauna they might find in a garden.
Well, and for anyone that spends any amount of time outside in your garden, whether you're planting or weeding, insects come walking by or they come flying by or you see them on the plant that you're working with. And another one that I had looked at in this book that I've always wondered what the heck it was. I thought it looked really cool. And so just for that fact alone, I left it alone, and now I find that I've been doing the good thing. It's a jagged ambush bug.
Oh, yes. Ambush bugs are really, really interesting. These are predators that oftentimes will rest in flowers or on plant leaves, and they will ambush unsuspecting prey. And many of them are brightly colored, and one type is the jagged ambush bug, and that has sort of some jagged edges around its abdomen that form its wing covers.
Well, I know I've seen them in the sunflowers is where I typically find these guys. And I've never been really squeamish about insects at all. So whenever my kids were outside, I'd say, hey, come over here and take a look at this really cool looking insect. And I think that's something else that's important is don't look at insects as being something that could harm you right off the bat. I mean, there are some of those that are out there, but not all insects are like that.
No, so these are beneficial, but of course, you know, because they're predators, they're going to be, they're meat eaters, right? And so some of them can bite. So we note in the book, those insects that you would want to handle with care. Most of these insects are not going to bite you, but there are a few that can sting or bite you, and so I always make sure to note that, so if people want to collect them and take a closer look, they'll be aware, you know, not to just grab them. But yeah.
Why don't you talk about how the book is organized in chapters?
Sure. So I broke the book down into an introduction that talks about just some of the main information you need to know about natural enemies, the basics, so their life cycles and eating habits. So I talk about what the difference is between a predator and a parasitoid. A predator is an active hunting insect that finds its own food at the stages that eat pests, whether that's the adult and the larva, or just the larva or immature stage. And then also parasitoids, which live quite a different life, where the females find the prey for their offspring, and the prey develop on or within that, or the offspring develop on or within that prey. So we go from there into biological control in home gardens, and that's where I discuss how people can increase the abundance of some of these insects in their home garden through different habitat management strategies. And then the third chapter is about monitoring and collecting good garden bugs, and we talk about some different techniques. I have pictures of my students and laboratory researchers collecting insects in that chapter. And then from there, I break it down into the main groups. And so each chapter is an order or class of insects or arthropods, and it will talk about some of the main families, genera, and species within that group that people should keep an eye out for.
So let's start with the first chapter. Why is it important to know the life cycle and the eating habits of these natural enemies?
Well, this is going to let people have an idea what they should be looking for. So sometimes people might recognize the adult stage, but they might not realize that the larval or nymphal stage of the insect is the same insect. And so I go over what those different life stages are. I also talk about the difference between gradual and complete metamorphosis. So in gradual metamorphosis, an insect hatches from an egg and goes through several immature stages, which are called nymphs, before reaching the adult stage, and they don't have a pupa. So, for instance, you're never going to see a cocoon of a praying mantis because they do not make a cocoon. They have an egg stage, several nymphal stages, and then an adult. Same thing for a minute pirate bug or a damsel bug or that ambush bug. But many insects have what's called complete metamorphosis, and there you're going to have an egg which hatches into a larva, which feeds and eventually develops into a pupa, which then hatches into an adult. And in these insects with complete metamorphosis, the larval and adult stage oftentimes look very different. For example, a lady beetle larva is a long, thin, sort of worm-like creature with lots of spines and three pairs of legs. It looks quite a bit different than an adult, but they both feed on prey. In order to be able to identify these, you need to know just the basics of how they live their lives.
I remember a couple of years ago, I was interviewing our extension entomologist here, Diane Alston, at Utah State University, and we had a caller who said that I've got what looks like, I've been squishing these insects, and they look like little alligators. And she and I both looked at each other and went, no, don't do that, because
exactly.
They were later lady beetle larvae. And they're, in fact, isn't that the stage where they eat the most aphids? Is that stage?
It is. They can eat up to 400 aphids or other prey during their larval stages. And so they're very voracious predators as larvae, and many insects are.
I'm also looking at their different eating habits. You know, why is that important? Just to provide food for them?
Well, it's important to understand how things feed, because you want to know what stages might be beneficial in the garden and also what resources they need to survive. So with predators, they're typically going to be generalists, so they're going to feed on many different types of insects in the garden. And the larval stage and the adult stage, if they feed on prey, will forage for their own prey. And then for parasitoids, most often they're more specialized. So they feed on one type of prey or maybe a few types of prey within an insect family or order. And they're the females, and this is mostly going to be wasps and flies, although there's parasitism present in other orders of insects. But say the female wasp, she'll fly to a potential prey say, a caterpillar, she'll sting that caterpillar with her ovipositor and deposit one or more eggs either on or inside it, depending on the species, and then those larvae will develop, killing the caterpillar. And people might see parasitoid females doing this. They might also see dead caterpillars with cocoons or aphids that have been killed by parasitoids, which we call aphid mummies. And evidence of the work of natural enemies is sometimes easier to spot than the insects themselves. Some of these parasitoid wasp females are very tiny, but you can find the evidence of their activity when you find the cocoons or pupae of their developing offspring.
Now, can parasitoids be purchased so you can release them into your own garden?
You can purchase many different types of natural enemies, including parasitoids. This is called augmentative biological control. Honestly, augmentative biological control, in my opinion, is most effective within closed spaces like a greenhouse or a hoop house or high tunnel where someone might be growing plants under partial or completely closed conditions, or starting plants early in the season, because then the insects are released within a certain environment where they have to forage. When we release insects into the open garden, oftentimes they leave the area and you're not likely to get a strong decrease in pest control or pest abundance as a result.
And you address this with the convergent lady beetle, which is where when you go into a store and you see lady beetles for sale, I mean, you can get kind of excited, like, wow, I can have more lady beetles. But when you realize that when you release them, they take off and they don't stick around, then it's not really worth sometimes the money to have them in. So how do you know what you're getting is going to work in your garden?
Well, what I suggest people do is spend their money concentrating on building a better habitat in their backyard. And so there's many different plant species that can be purchased to provide pollen and nectar resources for natural enemies. So we all think about bees needing pollen and nectar, but natural enemies also feed on these resources. So by adding pollen and nectar resources, things that bloom throughout the season in your garden, you're going to provide a better habitat for these species. And I give a lot of examples of annual and perennial plants to try.
Well, let's talk about some of those. I love borage and have eaten the leaves before, but that's you have a photo of borage here. It's an annual, but it's part of what you call the Sweet Seven.
Yes, so there's many annual plants that have been tested for their attractiveness to natural enemies, and I picked seven that are highly attractive and grow throughout most of the country as annual plants. And some of these are herbs like dill and coriander and also borage, really lovely plants that can be planted on their own, you know, in large plantings or in mixed plantings or containers, or even strips throughout a vegetable garden or on an edge as a buffer. Others of these include buckwheat, sweet alyssum, phasalia, and fava bean.
What insects do you see coming for the dill? Dill's not always been one of my favorite, but I thought, well, if I put it at the back of the garden, then maybe that's the best place to have it.
I see a lot of wasps foraging on my dill in my community garden plot. It's just starting to flower this week. We've had an incredible amount of rain this spring here in Ohio, but I noticed last week that my dill was starting to flower, and I always see a lot of wasps collecting pollen and nectar from my dill.
And it readily recedes.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's an easy one, and so you know, you want to plant it in an area where you don't mind that happening. But the nice thing about some of these annuals is that they are really inexpensive, typically as plants or as seeds. So it's a great budget way if you want to create a large planting or if you want to give this a try and see what types of natural enemies you're able to attract. These plants are a great place to start.
Cilantro is another one of those that, at least here, readily reseeds. Some might know it as coriander. Usually I refer to the seed as coriander seed and the plant as cilantro, but I've seen that one especially be great for attracting beneficial insects.
Oh, it is. It's teeming with insects. And, you know, I think sometimes our tendency, you're picking the cilantro for a while and then you sort of go on vacation or something and it bolts. And, you know, sometimes the tendency is to then remove it. But just go ahead and leave that because it'll flower for quite some time and it'll provide a lot of resources.
And then the buckwheat, I mean, that's a great cover crop to put into your garden and then just till it in toward the end of the season.
Yeah, buckwheat's used mostly for a cover crop. It's even used in larger scale agriculture as a cover crop, but it can be used as a garden cover crop. And those that have tried it know that early in the season, it really has a prolific blooming. So it can provide a lot of nectar early in the season when there isn't a lot of other resources available.
Now, address extra floral nectaries. I was not familiar with this term, but it seems kind of fascinating to me. Because normally you would think of nectars being only in the flower itself.
That's true. So some plants also produce nectar outside the flower. So flower plants that produce nectar in places other than their flowers are called plants that have extra floral nectaries. And actually, fava bean is an example of a plant that has extra floral nectaries. But these are plants that will produce nectar on their leaves, on their stems, in their sepals of their flowers, places other than the flower itself. And these are really accessible nectaries that any insect can feed from. So to get at some floral nectar, you have to have pretty specialized mouth parts. Like think of a butterfly being able to extend its proboscis down into a deep flower. With extra floral nectaries, the nectar is right there at the surface, and even insects that don't have these specialized mouthparts can go ahead and feed on this. And it's thought that the plants produce this as a way to protect themselves against pests. So if they can attract predatory insects to feed on these extra floral nectaries, then the predatory insects are there ready to consume pests that might be damaging the plants.
Is that why I always see ants in my sunflowers?
Sunflowers do produce extra floral nectaries. Peonies produce extra floral nectaries. And so those are two examples where a lot of people will see insects, you know, running up and down the plants and wonder what they're doing, and that's what they're doing. But there's a large diversity of plants, from cacti to many trees that do this, to many different types of herbaceous plants.
You've got a couple of pages here showing native plants for natural enemies, and like the coneflower, goldenrod, any other suggestions? What's just a couple off the top of your head from here that you would think would be the best?
Well, it really depends on the part of the country that you're in. And so one of the key things that you have to do, I give here some genera of plants, such as milkweed, asters, goldenrods, things like that are highly attractive. And then what people are going to want to do is look for plant lists for their specific area that are going to provide native plants that are going to fit the bill in those genera. And the Xerces Society, which is a conservation organization, has produced some really great resources for determining plantings in any part of the country. They have regional plant lists, and that would be a great place I would suggest people start.
I know, just looking at the photos, rabbit brush is very common around here.
Rabbit brush is a great option for your area, and that was one of the suggested plants from the Xerces Society.
The sage, of course, and then penstemons or beard tongues. Utah has more penstemons than anywhere else in the world, so that would just be natural for around here.
Absolutely, and those are lovely too.
Tell me about, how do you provide shelter for these beneficial insects?
That's a good question. So this can be as simple or as complex as people want to make it. So insects during the winter need to seek shelter, and they also need shelter from the hot sun and from their predators. And so during the heat of the day, they may seek shelter in things like a wood pile or under sticks and rocks and mulch. So providing mulch habitats, rock gardening is a great way to provide natural shelter. Any sort of wood that's incorporated within gardens, fencing and things like that provide cracks and crevices for insects to hide. And then during winter, they're also going to seek shelter from the elements within some of these structures. So if you have bedding plants that you're growing, at the end of the season, leave some of that vegetation there. Don't completely remove everything down to the dirt, because all of that that drying out plant material is really habitat for these insects. So I talk about ways to naturally provide these habitats, and then there's also a lot of different shelters that you can purchase or make for natural enemies and for pollinators. People may have seen some of the native bee hotel ideas that are coming up, and these can be really simple boxes with holes for stem nesting bees, or they can be really elaborate boxes with many different types of stem nesting bee resources. And stem nesting wasps will also use these resources. There are even things online called lady beetle houses or butterfly houses that are little boxes that have little slats, and the idea is that the natural enemies will crawl inside. I've never done one of these myself, and I wondered if I should include them in the book, and I contacted several people who had blog posted about using these. And from what I can tell, these boxes are likely to be colonized, but they're more likely to be colonized by wasps than by lady beetles. And so wasps are very beneficial. They consume a large amount of pests within a garden area, but if you're going to put out one of these boxes and to see if anything colonizes it, I would just not put it close to a door or other area if you're, you know, nervous being around wasps, because quite honestly, that's probably what's going to use them.
Yeah, I've noticed in the last 10 years quite an influx of the European paper wasp, and it's been more of almost a pest, but maybe I should be looking at it at different, because there has been a local, I don't know if it's local or national, but there's some kind of a pathogen that has been getting into them and suppressing the populations. So that's been helpful. So tell me what they eat.
Well, European paper wasps are one of those examples of an invasive species that's been introduced and has been implicated in the decline of some of our native fauna. And these wasps do eat a tremendous amount of prey, like caterpillars and other pests in the garden, but they are more aggressive than some of our native paper wasp species. I know I lived in Idaho for a while, and they decided to nest in my snowboard rack in my car. That was a problem because no one could get in the doors of the car without them coming out. So if they're nesting in a tree far away, you know, from somewhere where you need to interact and they're consuming a bunch of prey, then a homeowner might consider them a benefit. But if they're nesting right above your door frame or something and, you know, being a potential risk, then obviously they're less beneficial. But they are voracious predators.
They seem to really like nesting in the ends of the clothesline, the metal posts.
They like holes like that, yes.
Okay, so I'm on chapter 4. And I'm talking with Mary Gardner. She's author of Good Garden Bugs, Everything You Need to Know About Beneficial Predatory Insects. And so I'm looking at your couple of pages on mantids, native and non-natives. And so that brings to mind a question. We were just talking about the paper wasp. When we say beneficial insects or predatory insects, they're not always completely good for the garden, but you include them in here and you talk about how they can be beneficial in your landscape.
Yeah, so not all insects are native to the U.S. Insects are introduced both accidentally and purposefully over the many years that they've colonized our country. And there's two exotic mantid species that are found in the U.S., the European mantid and the Chinese mantid. To my knowledge, there isn't any evidence that the presence of these mantids have displaced any other mantid species, but I can't be 100% sure about that. But they are very beneficial in that they're predators and they consume a lot of different pests. There is also several native mantid species, especially in the western U.S. You have more mantid diversity than we have here in Ohio. So it was kind of fun to be able to talk about some of these cool things for people to keep an eye out for.
And there is a difference between what people say are bugs, which are insects, but not all insects are bugs.
That's true. That's definitely an entomologist thing. many people consider all insects to be bugs, and we called the book Good Garden Bugs. But in fact, only Chapter 5 talks about the true bugs. Those are insects in the order Hemiptera, and they are both pests and predators. There's many different species in the order Hemiptera. I discuss the predatory fauna here, and one of the cool things about the predatory Hemiptera is that they all feed through a modified mouth part that looks like a straw, and they're able to stab their prey with the straw and then suck out the liquid contents of it.
The piercing, sucking mouth part.
Yes.
As we talk about in the Zesty Garden.
And these are some of the biters. So some of these won't bite you or it won't hurt if you pick them up. A few of these will cause a painful bite, and that's because they have a proteolytic enzyme that they produce when they stab their prey that liquefies the prey internal contents and allows them to eat it through that mouth part.
When I'm looking at your stink bugs, I've had in my mind that I want to crush all stink bugs because I see them getting onto my peaches, I see them on other vegetables in the garden, but And I know all of the photos you have here aren't all in the Inner Mountain West, but there are some that are quite lovely looking, and it makes sense that they would be like in places like Florida. But then there are others like the spined soldier bug that I probably should be more on the lookout for.
Yeah, that is one that you're going to find. So, yes, many stink bugs are pests. And here in the east, we have the brown marmorated stink bug, which is an invasive stink bug making its way west. And so people really have had a negative implication when it comes to stink bugs. But these stink bugs can also, some species are very important predators, such as the spine soldier bug. To separate the spine soldier bug from other stink bugs, you want to look at the shoulders or the top of the pronotum. It has these projecting little points, and it also has a black spot on the back of its wing covers. And that's going to separate that particular species from some of the pests.
Water bugs, do you want to address that just a little bit? We've even got what you call them water striders. I don't know where I got the name penny bug from them, but, you know, they're quite common around here.
Yeah, so gardening with water has become so popular, and so I wanted to tell people a little bit about some of the cool things that might be foraging down inside their water features, and water striders are probably the most common. They almost look like little spiders when they're flittering across the water because they have these long, thin legs. Of course, they only have six, not eight, but they're a predatory insect. They can dive underwater and store water in some of their hairs, but we typically see them looking across the striding across the water looking for prey.
Hmm. And would they be the most common here in the West as well?
In garden ponds, I would say they're one of the most likely things you're going to see. Some of these things in the book are a little bit deeper down, and you might need to scoop out some of the bottom of the pond and take a closer look in some Tupperware so that you can see what's foraging around. But I'd say that the striders are the most commonly witnessed garden insect, pond insect.
Let's move along. I wanted to make sure we talked about lacewings. They're of course, quite common around here, and I would imagine probably throughout the country, but they're especially beneficial.
Lacewings are neat, and yes, they are very beneficial and common in the Inner Mountain West. The larvae of lacewings, this is another one that's sometimes called alligator-like. So the larvae are long and thin, and they have these piercing jaws that they will pierce their prey and then allow the liquid contents to go through their jaws and into their mouth. They're a voracious aphid predator. The adults are really lovely insects. The green lacewing has a long, slender green body and four net-veined wings. Some green lacewing adults also feed on aphids and other prey. Some feed just on pollen and nectar, and some don't feed at all during the adult stage. People may find these on their front porch if you've left your porch light on. They do come to lights at night, so that can be a good indication that they're present.
Now, with the lacewings, is there a tree cricket that looks kind of like a green lacewing?
Some tree crickets also have large wings that can look like leaves or have a lot of veins in them, so they might look similar. The lacewings' legs are a little bit different in that they don't have the jumping legs, and they also have very, very long antennae as adults.
And let's move along and talk about beetles. Now, beetles tend to get a lot of the attention because they're big. A lot of them are big, and they can be quite colorful looking. So how do you know what to look for as far as a good beetle?
Well, the beetles are the largest order of insects, although the hymenoptera or wasps are thought to actually be. It's just they haven't all been accounted for yet. So there's kind of two major groups. There's many groups of beetles that are predators, but two of the major ones are ground beetles and lady beetles that are very speciose and common in the garden. So the ground beetles, they range from pretty small, like just a few millimeters, up to more than a couple centimeters, so some of these are quite big. They're oftentimes black and shiny with striations or indentations running the length of their wing covers, and they can also be metallic, so there's many metallic ground beetles. They're called ground beetles because many species forage at the ground level and will feed on things like cutworms, snails, and slugs, and many different types of insects. Although a few will climb up plants or trees and look for caterpillars and beetle larvae and other pests above in the canopy.
I'm looking here at 3 pages of photos of lady beetles. Who would have thought there were that many? Now, I know that the 7-spotted lady beetle has recently appeared here in Utah, and or maybe it's the 9-spotted. I can't remember which one. It's the only one that keeps coming into the house.
That's the multicolored Asian lady beetle.
Ah, okay. And so I recognize a few of these others, but that's probably one of my favorite beetles just because of all of the great things that they do.
Mine too. There's actually a few things going on. So one reason there's so many lady beetles is a significant part of my research program focuses on lady beetles. So they've always been something that I'm interested in. And I think that they're very charismatic, and this might be a way to engage some people who weren't so excited about predators and parasitoids because they are very lovely and diverse. And people can even monitor these and participate in a citizen science program called the Lost Ladybug Project, where you can document different species that you're finding in your garden. So that's a fun way to contribute to science and learn a little bit more about the fauna in your own yard. Many people think of lady beetles as being a red insect with black spots, but as you can see here through our pictures in the book, they range from having black wing covers with red spots to even metallic blue wing covers or yellow, so there's quite a diversity of different patterns.
I love the checker spot lady beetle. That one's just, I mean, it's yellow instead of orange, but it's really kind of cool looking.
The checker spot lady beetle is a neat lady beetle. That actually is a pretty relatively recently found lady beetle here in Ohio. It is a non-native species. It was detected here in the early 2000s and has become quite common, especially we're finding a lot of them in urban areas. And the wing covers are yellow, and they have black spots, but the spots are square-shaped, so it really does look like a checkerboard.
I'm looking at fireflies, and this has become interesting for me because you don't usually think of Utah as having fireflies, and typically there isn't, but there's a population of them in Nibley, which is here in the Cache Valley, that my cousin pointed out to me, and they've recently been flashing their lights and going out there and taking a look at them. It's just phenomenal because you just don't see them in Utah.
Yeah, that's really surprising. I actually didn't realize that there was any light-producing fireflies that far west. Most of the light-producing species are in the east. In the west, you do have fireflies, but not all fireflies produce light. And so some of the western ones that are quite common do not do that, but they are predatory.
I'm not sure what makes that particular area or how they got introduced to there. Maybe somebody brought them from elsewhere in the country and then released them. But it's in kind of a somewhat damp area, so I think that probably helps them out. But it's one of only,
yeah,
I think, 2 documented in the state.
Wow.
So that's kind of fun. So whirligig beetles, I love the name. Where do you usually see those? Is that just in the water?
Whirligig beetles are an aquatic beetle. They are called whirligig beetles because of the way they swim. They swim in groups, and they tend to swim in sort of an erratic pattern. The really cool thing about whirligig beetles is that they have 2 pairs of eyes. They have 1 pair that's above the water and 1 pair that's below the water, so they can see what's going on above the water as well as what's going on below.
And just to kind of finish up here, I do want to look at your wasps and ants section. That's your chapter 9. And again, this is the book, Good Garden Bugs, Everything You Need to Know About Beneficial Predatory Insects. And I'm interviewing the author, Mary Gardner. And Mary, so as I'm looking at these, there's such a variety of wasps. And I've tried to tell people, typically, anything that's flying, they call them bees. And I'm like, they're not bees, they're wasps. And they're going to be really good. Like even the big bald-faced hornets that build those lantern-shaped nests, unless it's by a door or a window somewhere or a picnic table where you would be all the time, I'd just say leave it, because they're doing so much good.
They do, and many, many wasps do not sting people. So parasitoid wasps that we talked about at the beginning of the program that are looking for their own host for their larva, these are some of the wasps with what looks like a really long stinger. And people can see these and understandably so become quite fearful. That would really hurt if that thing stung me. Some of them have a what's called an ovipositor, which looks like the stinger, of more than an inch in length, sometimes a few inches for some species that attack larvae inside trees. But these parasitoids cannot sting people or pets. Their ovipositor is just used to sting their prey and deposit an egg inside, so they represent no threat. And a lot of times when you see these, they're on flowers. They do feed on pollen and nectar to sustain themselves as adults. And so some of them are quite lovely, very colorful. They really add a lot of benefit and also interest in the garden.
Do you have mud daubers there?
We do have mud daubers, yes.
Love those. What do they do in the environment?
Mud daubers are a solitary stinging wasp. So mud daubers can sting, but you really have to harass one to get it to sting you. They build their own solitary nest. So each female will build a nest of mud, and she will provision that nest with prey and lay her eggs inside of it. And so you will never see, you know, a colony of mud daubers. It just doesn't happen. They each have their own nest. You may find several together, but you're not going to see them living socially like the bald-faced hornet, as you said.
So these are what I see out in the barn. I have kind of an open, large shed, barn size, and I see mud nests in the corners. Is that from the mud daubers?
It could be from mud daubers. There's a few different potter or mason wasps that build nests like that it could be, but that is one common one.
So let's finish up with spiders. Arachnid family, and I see that you have a hobo spider here, which if I see one in my basement, the remote comes out and I usually whack it pretty good, because this is one of the few that we have here that can be a little more dangerous.
The hobo spider is a unique one. You know, when I was living in Idaho, it was made really clear to us to get rid of them in houses because they can create a pretty significant bite, and so I always did the same thing. I was reading when I was working on this book that some of that might be overstated,
yeah.
That actually it might not be the hobo spider, but I would still suggest to people, if you're finding these in your house, to remove them. Certainly there's no reason to take a risk like that in the house, but in the natural, and it also is a non-native species, but in the natural environment, Agelinidae, the funnel web weavers, the family of the hobo spider, there are many native spider species in that family that build funnel webs outside that, you know, aren't common in inside houses and don't represent a threat to anybody except for their prey.
And I'll typically get a cup and have it run into the cup and then throw them outside, because I know how much good they're doing, how many bad insects are being picked up, especially in these webs. Another one that's common around here would be what we call cat face spider.
Mm-hmm.
And they can get kind of large, at least for the Intermountain West here. But we've even had one hanging in our kitchen in the window. So as fall approached and it got colder outside and the flies would buzz around, we'd turn the light off except right where that spider happened to be, and the flies would go right into it. It's kind of cool to show your kids.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a great one for kids because it's big enough that everybody can watch it easily and see it without a microscope. That's a type of orb weaver. They build a large Charlotte's web type spider web, big round web, and are fun to watch. They overwinter as an egg case, and then in the spring, the spiderlings will hatch and form their own webs.
Well, I have to say that I've really enjoyed looking through this book and reading in the chapters, and I've found it very beneficial for myself because of the color photos and being able to identify exactly, you know, what is it that I have out in my garden. This is Good Garden Bugs, Everything You Need to Know About Beneficial Predatory Insects, and I've been talking with the author, Mary Gardner. Mary, thank you so much for joining me on the program.
Thank you. It was fun to talk.
You're listening to the Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That segment. Today with me is Jerry Goodspeed, USU Horticulture Extension Agent, and we're going to talk about bishop's weed. Explain what bishop's weed is.
It's used as a ground cover, and normally it sits in the shade into underneath trees, and it'll fill in real thick. It's appropriately named bishop's weed, and I've always told people, you know, there are a lot of plants out there that you look at them and you think, well, I wonder if that's going to be weedy or not. And sometimes they have a really touchy or a real fun name. But if the plant comes with the name weed, that kind of tells you a little bit about it. It's very aggressive. It grows by rhizomes, underground roots, if you will, or stems that'll just keep moving. And it has a variegated leaf, a blue or a green and a white leaf. And
isn't people love that pretty?
Yes, it's one of those, oh, I love that thing in the little pot that it's in. And then about 3 years later, you're wondering why it's in the middle of your lawn and why it's taken over the flower beds, and everywhere else you didn't put it is where it ends up. And one of the reasons is because it's a weed, oddly enough.
Now, I've seen this come up in grass.
Yeah.
I've seen this completely take over a shady area.
Oh,
what
yeah.
if it gets lots of sun?
And then it just looks ugly, but it still overtakes everything.
So it just keeps going.
Yeah, I don't think it cares whether it's sun. But what happens in full sun is it normally burns out, and so you'll get some crispy leaves in the middle of the summer where it just looks uglier than normal. I don't know.
Is there anywhere in the landscape that you would suggest having this weed?
I'm okay with it being planted in the shade, but make sure that you have a barrier around it, at least 6 inches down in the ground, so that it can't move into your lawn, so it can't move into your neighbor's house, abandoned Chevy, whatever's over there. So you're trying to keep it in place. And then the other thing to do about with Bishop's weed is mow it down in the middle of summer. So it'll grow up and it'll send out this kind of ugly flower. And then what I tell most people, and then it starts to burn out. It starts to get a little bit of burned leaves on it. If you want it to come back and look good, literally just mow it down with a mower, with a string trimmer, whatever it is you can use, mow it back. And it'll make you feel good because then you're chopping at it. And anytime you can knock back a weed, that makes you feel good.
So will it keep it in check a little bit more when you mow it? Is it like an or is it like an aspen when you cut it down, it just sprouts all over the place?
I don't know if it hurts or helps it sprout more. All I know is that when after we mow it, when it comes back, it looks better. It has new green, white leaves that look a lot better. And sometimes what'll happen, the other thing that you have to watch with the Bishop's weed is every once in a while, it'll get tired of just being white and the variegated leaf, the white and the green leaf. And you'll look out there and there'll be a patch of just green leaves. So, yeah.
So it sounds like the genes for it aren't very stable.
Yeah, that's probably a good way to put it, yeah. Yeah, it tends to get bored with just being two colored and goes back to one, and then it burns a little bit, so it actually throws in a brown in there.
Have you seen with variegation in plants in general that tends to be an unstable thing? I've seen that in iris as well.
Yeah, it depends on the plant. Some plants, yeah. Not all, but yeah, some plants, it gets tired of it.
So why would anyone really want to have Bishop's weed? Can you think of any good reason?
Oh, in-laws. As I said,
somebody's car instead of zucchini, you fill it full of Bishop's weed.
There's another thought. I hadn't thought about that, but there we go. We could probably think of a couple of uses for it. But as generally as a ground cover, I don't recommend it.
Okay. Yep. Well, today's plant not to plant is Bishop's weed. Avoid it like the plague. And that is the recommendation from Jerry Goodspeed, USU's Horticulture Extension Agent, for today's Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That. Thanks for joining me today.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams in for Petals and Prose. And because it's been so dry and we're having drought all over the West, I want to talk to you today a little bit about water and how important it is, not only for your gardens, of course, but also for the bird garden that I hope that you've planted, your bird and bee garden. So we have to think of ways to attract birds and pollinators to our gardens through the year. One of those ways that sometimes we forget is water. So this is a reading that comes from a book published by the National Audubon Society called The Bird Garden, A Comprehensive Guide to Attracting Birds to Your Backyard Throughout the Year by Stephen W. Kress. And he writes about water in the gardens. In very dry habitats, water is even more attractive to some visiting birds than food. Water may also be scarce in northwestern and northeastern states, especially during the summer. It is inaccessible for most of the northern winter, locked away in ice and snow. Birds can obtain much of the water they require in their food, but all species need it, both for drinking and bathing throughout the year. Providing clean water in the correct backyard habitat and at the right time of the year is difficult. But persevere, because an area of open water, no matter how small, is one of the most useful tools for attracting birds to the backyard. In this chapter, there's practical advice on building a small pond, as well as a list of plants that are ideal for landscaping a garden pond. There are also bird baths, which birds need to be clean. A predator-safe bird bath that offers open water throughout the year will help attract birds that seldom visit feeders, such as warblers and vireos. All birds, ranging in size from eagles to chickadees, bathe in water at any time of the year. Bird baths are generally sold with raised pedestals or stands, but it seems that many species prefer baths at ground level, the normal location for natural rain puddles. However, a pedestal bird bath does provide necessary protection from cats. You can make a bird bath from a household item such as a trash can lid. Place the lid close to the ground or on a stack of cement blocks. Bird baths require a gentle incline of no more than 2 or 3 inches, and the trash can lid is an ideal shape. Avoid plastic lids since they have slippery sides and birds will find it difficult to gain a foothold. A shallow ceramic pot saucer is another possibility. Change the water every few days and scrub off any algae which thrive in bird-fertilized water. The location of a bird bath determines which birds it will attract. Bold species such as robins and jays visit bird baths in open areas or near shrubs. But little warblers, wood thrushes, and other birds that like shade are more likely to use those that you place in protected spots. Do not put additives in the water to lower the freezing point. Keep the bird bath free of ice during northern winters with a submersible, thermostatically controlled heater designed for outdoor bird baths. You can also use a water drip. The backyard bird bath can be made much more appealing to birds by the creation of a rippling motion on the water's surface. This attracts the attention of birds flying by the garden that might otherwise overlook the water source. Dripping water is especially attractive to warblers, which are drawn by the sound and the motion of the drip meeting the surface of the still water. Fast-flowing, powerful sprays can startle and disperse birds. The most effective way is to provide dripping water by the installation of an adapter especially designed for bird use, called, oddly, the water drip. This system includes a special Y valve that is attached to an exterior water tap. The water flows into a hose attached to a hook-shaped metal pipe that then trickles water into the bird bath at a preset rate. The fountain mist is another device designed for birds. This brings water from the exterior tap to a fountain spray that is placed in the center of the bird bath. The height of the spray can vary. A simpler method is to bring a plastic bucket with a hole punched in the bottom to hang it over the bird bath. Start with a small nail hole and keep enlarging it until a regular pattern of water drips from the bucket. About 20 to 30 drops per minute is ideal. Cover the bucket to reduce evaporation and prevent clogging. You can also put in a backyard pond, if you're so inclined. These are particularly useful in arid or hot climate zones where water sources are scarce for most of the year, so they work well in the West. You need a clean location. Make sure you place the pond far enough away from bird feeders so that it's not a repository for seed hulls and dropped grain. Choose a site within easy reach of the garden hose, since cleaning a water source is important for the birds and other occasional wildlife visitors. The shape of the pond does not affect its attractiveness to birds, but the pitch of the slope is very important. Ideally, the pond should grade gently from 1/2 inch of water to no more than 4 inches at the deepest point. This slope allows birds to wade in safely. If you have inherited a garden pond with deeper sides, adapt it to attract birds by half-submerging small boulders and stones around its edge. Plant a few bird-attracting plants in and around those. Ponds measuring several square feet wide and containing both shallow and deep water will attract not only smaller birds like warblers, but also larger birds like robins and jays. Tree swallows and purple martins are attracted to larger-sized ponds, and they may decide to take up residence nearby. Swallows in the trees, martins in a multi-level home, mounted on a pole, since they prefer to build their nests close to the water. There is much more here in greater detail about making the pond, which I'm not going to share with you, and what to use for liners. I would just like to read a little list of some of the aquatic plants that will attract birds to your water source, whatever kind you've got. Bulrushes. They are important wetland plants for water and marsh birds if you want those. Cordgrass is attractive. Sedge grass. Tufted sedge. If you have a pond, you can grow water lilies on it. There are species that will grow here. Common buttonbrush. Water lilies and arrowhead plant are all things that will grow in water. And of course, what I always suggest is that you check with a nurseryman or woman who is experienced in that. And we have several locally that could help you choose the plants that would be good in your water source. Again, this is from the book called The Bird Garden, published by National Audubon Society by Stephen W. Kress. I've enjoyed sharing this with you, and I'll see you next time. I'm Nancy Williams for Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earl. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.